The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
I feel but one way. You will understand it too. In these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We are also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Joe Esterhaas. His writing credits include Flashdance, Jagged Edge, Music Box, and Basic Instinct. In addition to screenplays, he's been a journalist, and he has written best-selling books, American Rhapsody and Hollywood Animal. His newest book is The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, which we will be talking about today, and I'm just delighted to have him. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Barbara. It's nice to be here.
It's so great to talk to you. I have this image of you there was an article that I read about you years ago in, must have been the LA Times, or maybe it was a San Francisco paper, but I think you were living in Marin at the time. And it was this entire piece about one of your movies was just coming out, and it was talking about you as being, you know, an extremely high paid, if not the highest paid screenwriter, and very much a rebel at the same time. And I so admired that, that you were able to be successful and not sell out to Hollywood and all of the powers there that be.
Thank you. I fought the good fight. I've been doing scripts for 30 years. I've had 15 movies made. There's been a fight on every single movie. The what I really know about and what's in the book is how a screenwriter can survive in Hollywood without suffering either a physical or a spiritual death. So that's what I've learned in all the years.
Well, the book is great. I've read a bunch of books about screenwriting, and this, I have to say, must be the most honest book about screenwriting.
Thank you.
And also one of the most encouraging, really.
Thank you. I meant it to be encouraging. You know, I think screenwriters for so long have been at the bottom of the totem pole, and all you hear about usually are the screenwriter horror stories, nightmare stories in which the screenwriter is somehow victimized. One of the reasons I wrote this book is to offer screenwriters a kind of moral support and guidance. You know, if the book can serve a little bit as some kind of a pole to hang on to when a screenwriter gets into those battles with people who try to truncate his work, then I will be happy if it serves that purpose.
Yeah, I found it really informative and as I said, really encouraging. And I'm so curious, too. You have a journalism background. You've written books. You've written screenplays. I would assume journalism came first.
Yeah, I grew up in a poor neighborhood in Cleveland, and went to Ohio University. And from the time I was 13 years old, I wanted to write. I knew that I would somehow have to support myself writing, and I thought the easiest way to do that would be to do journalism. So I was a journalism English major. The other thing that journalism did for me, frankly, is because I'm an immigrant and I came here when I was 6 years old, it really made me listen to the way people speak. I think it really developed my ear because I was constantly listening with a foreigner's ear to modes of expression and to slang and to things like that. But it also forced me to go out into the society and meet people. I was intensely shy as a boy, and journalism forced me into situations and forced me into confronting people and asking them questions. And maybe that's the greatest thing that it did for me.
Hmm. If you just turned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Joe Esterhaas today, and it's just wonderful, wonderful to have you here. So did you have writers in your family? Were you trained as a writer?
My dad was a Hungarian novelist, and he worked in this country as the editor of a Hungarian language newspaper in Cleveland. And he always encouraged me from the time I was very little to read. He said, reading is the key to life, and you must read, read, read. And, of course, because he was my father, and I think because he was an immigrant in an American, in a foreign, strange American society, I really didn't listen to him. And until I was 13 or so, I got into various kinds of juvenile trouble. I was mostly in the streets and the alleys playing ball and doing other things. And at 13, I almost got into some very, very serious juvenile trouble that could have sent me to jail. And I realized that I had to do something to change my life or I would have a very, very bad life. And I began to read. I read from that point on. I've read voraciously. You know, in the first couple of years at that age, I would make long lists of what I read and character outlines and profiles and little notes about the authors. I really went on a very intense autodidactic sort of reading course, and it was the reading that freed me from that slum on the west side of Cleveland and freed me from the world that I was in and really helped me to live in my imagination.
Were there any books from back then or a book that sort of turned you around or changed your life?
you wouldn't expect what the book was. I remember the book. It was a book by Jules Verne called Michael Strogoff.
Uh-huh.
And it was it was one of the typical Verne kinds of things. It's set in Russia with Cossacks and horsemen and all of that. And I don't know why that book really moved me, but that's the one that started it all. And then I sort of, read indiscriminately, promiscuously, A.J. Cronin, C.S. Forster, Tennessee Williams. There was a little paperback bookstore down the street that was really a front for a bookie wire in the back. And then the guy led me in there, and at that point they charged 5 cents for a paperback. And these were paperbacks with the cover that had been torn off. And after he saw how much I was reading, he just let me have the books as long as I brought them back. And I read anything and everything. It didn't matter what it was. I read Tennessee Williams, I know, at a very, very young age. And he struck a chord in me, and I really loved his work.
Hmm. So most people, in terms of, screenwriting or looking forward to being a screenwriter, most people come to Hollywood or want to live in Hollywood, want to live in L.A. and think that that's how you make it as a screenwriter, but it seems that you've lived everywhere but.
I lived in Hollywood. I lived in Malibu for about 10 years, and then got out and came back to Ohio, where I'm from and where my wife is from. The reason I don't think screenwriters should live in Hollywood is because it isn't the schmoozing that matters. It isn't the networking. That's all irrelevant. What matters is to write something that someone thinks they can make money with. The best way to do that is not to set up a deal and to try to pitch and hustle and to try and to sort of feel like Willie Loman at the end of the day, but to sit down and write whatever is in your heart and soul and gut and put it down on paper and write it as a spec screenplay. Then send it out. Try to get it out there. And believe me, if someone reads that and thinks there's money to be made, someone will buy it. It will attract someone, and someone will buy it. The best example of how that works that I can give you is in about 1991, I sold a script called Original Sin in an auction, pretty publicized auction in Hollywood. I sold it to Synergy at the time. The script went into development. 2 years later, the man who headed Synergy, Andy Voina, called me and he said, "I'm going to send you a script that you must read immediately." So I get this script, and it was written by a young mailman in Chicago. Well, it was my script of Original Sin, literally on my manual typewriter, Xeroxed, with a new title and his name on it. What had happened, we discovered, is that he had taken a screenwriting course in Chicago, where part of the course was Original Sin, simply taken it home, Xeroxed it, put his name on it. But the point of this story is that he then sent it to a Chicago agent, who sent it to a Los Angeles agent, and he sold what was my script for $600,000. Now, the moral of this story is, you know, if you live in Chicago, if you write something, you can get it to a Chicago agent who'll get it to an L.A. agent. And I think same thing applies if you live in Duluth or Kalamazoo, sure, or wherever, because at this point, there are agents everywhere.
Interesting. Oh, poor guy, though, huh?
Well, we came down on him like major elephants, and I'm sure that we caused some serious writing blocks in his future if he ever really sat down and tried to write something.
Yeah, there's a big no-no when it comes to plagiarism.
Big no-no, but it does show that it's possible.
And you're all listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here today with Joe Esterhaus. His new book is The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, The Screenwriter as God.
And that's my favorite part of the title, incidentally, The Screenwriter is God, because I do consider it, considering how screenwriters have been treated through the years, I think it's such a wonderful upraised middle finger to the powers that be.
So now how did this rebel aspect begin? I mean, were you always like that, or did you just start getting involved with Hollywood and just couldn't stand what was going on?
I don't know. I've always been ornery. I remember in the... Oh, I guess I was in the seventh grade at St. Emmerich School in Cleveland, and was taught by the nuns of the Sisters of the Divine Redeemer. And I remember one of the sisters bringing me up in front of the class after I'd done something that she thought was unseemly, I guess, and said, you know, "You're either going to wind up in jail or you're going to be very, very famous and successful one day." Thank God both things haven't happened, you know. Together, it would have been very bad.
So, but when you started being successful with your scripts, which is, again, I mean, you have been able to demand high pay for your work. How was it then to also not stand for a lot of what most writers do stand for because they feel they must? How did that all happen?
I just couldn't, you know, it's very possible that it's because of my background. As I say, you know, I came in as an immigrant. Mm-hmm. I was the victim of a great deal of marginalization and prejudice as a kid, and I saw my parents, you know, embarrassed in 100 different ways. You know, I was called names like DP and Greenhorn and queer and all of those things. And I think I developed, you know, a really big chip on my shoulder. And the notion of being made to feel like a second-class citizen is something that I couldn't tolerate. Screenwriters, historically, I discovered when I got into the business, were always treated as second-class citizens. And I said to myself, I don't care how they've been treated. I'm not going to be treated that way. And from the very beginning, when I was on, when I did Fist, and got into a gigantic fight with Sylvester Stallone, you know, my attitude was, if you mess me over, or if you try to mess me over, I'm going to mess you back. I don't like fighting. I really don't. But if someone picks a fight with me, I won't back off. And if you look at the past 30 years and the 50 movies and all the fights in a certain way, and my issues with Michael Ovitz in 89 and 90, it really all happened and over and over again in a situation where somebody either wanted to mess with my script or, in the Ovitz case, but personally wanted to mess with me.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you've been my hero.
And thank you.
Let me say again, I'm talking with Joe Esterhaus today, author of The Devil's Guide to Hollywood. Let's talk about a couple of your movies. And, well, actually, before we do, how do you know when your ideas are going to fly, and when you have an idea that you just need to sort of put away? I mean, you know, we know about your successes. Have you had ideas that you?
Oh, sure. You know, I must have in different drawers, I'm guessing 8 to 10 or 12 scripts where I stop writing on page 35 or 55 or 85, and it didn't go anywhere. It happens, and you know, sometimes I've gone back to it and I've thought of something and it's unlocked it. You know, and I redid the script or rewrote the script or finished the script. There was a case with a script that I did sometime in the 80s called Magic Man, which was about a disc jockey and this relationship with a Hungarian boy, very much like me, and the boy's relationship with his dad. Well, the script never really, firstly, it didn't sell, and for some reason I felt it never came together. When I met Naomi, my wife, she read everything that I'd ever written, and she read the script, and she said, this was in 94, many, many years after I wrote it, she said, I think what's wrong with this is that the real relationship between the son and the dad isn't really realized. The you go there, but it's never completed. It never comes together. And I reread it with that in mind, and I realized that she was right. And went back and rewrote the script with that in mind, changed its title to Telling Lies in America, and it was very quickly made, beautifully cast with Brad Renfro and Maximilian Schellen and Kevin Bacon and Calista Flockhart, and it was one of two American movies that were invited that year into the New York Film Festival. So, you know, that sprung me loose, and the going it with that idea really turned it into a script that was realized.
So Flashdance, now, was that the first? Was that your first movie?
No, Fist was my first movie.
Okay.
With Sylvester Stallone and Norman Jewison directed it. I wrote, I don't know, two or three scripts after Fist that weren't made. And then I wrote Flashdance. But what I really did is I rewrote Flashdance. The original script of Flashdance had been written by Tom Edley, who was a Canadian journalist and an American journalist. And the notion of that particular kind of dancing called flash dancing was really Tom's notion, as was the title. Don Simpson was the producer with Jerry Bruckheimer, and they brought me in to rewrite it, and I did. The story in Edley's script was completely different. It was a story about a young woman who was in love with a man in his 60s with a family and grandchildren, and there was this whole thing about Hell's Angels who come sweeping into a certain neighborhood. But what remained was the kind of dancing that they did, which was a kind of, you know, arty, somebody called it highfalutin stripping back in the day, and that's probably not far from the truth, and of course that wonderful title. So it was a rewrite But it was a very serious rewrite, although the credits on it, and I think the credit on the movie is a story by Hedley, screenplay by Hedley and Esterhaz. I wish that the credit would have read story by Hedley and Esterhaz, but the Writers Guild decided not to go that way. And you know what? Ultimately, without that character and what it's about, without that highfalutin stripping and without the title, there would not have been a movie. So I'm not, you know, when the credit determination was done, I called Tom Hedley and congratulated him.
Mm. And I think in your book you said something about the woman it was based on was a woman you knew, or someone who welded. Or...
I knew. I dated a young woman who was a welder. Yes. at Republic Steel in Cleveland, who came from the same blue collar neighborhood that I came from. And the other notion why I made her a welder was that I had researched a script a year or two earlier. That wasn't made, called Rowdy, which was about the Alaska pipeline. In the course of that research, I spoke to dozens of welders, because the movie was going to be about the welders who went to the pipeline in Oklahoma and in the south of New Orleans. And I'd done all this research on welders and welding and you know, their lifestyle and all of that. So that, combined with the experience of having known a young woman who was a welder, was what made me make her a welder in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jagged Edge, which I have to say is one of my favorite movies.
Thank you.
It was just on one of the movie channels, and I was so happy to catch it. And I'm so curious where that came from.
There hadn't been a courtroom thriller in a long time, since Anatomy of a Murder, really. And my former agent, who suddenly became the vice president of Columbia, Guy McElwain, and he said to me one day, and then Guy and I were and are really good friends, he said to me, you know, have you ever thought of doing a courtroom thriller? You know, there hasn't been one in a long time. Think about it. So I came up with the idea of doing the movie that's up on screen. And together with the producer Marty Rantzenhoff and Guy, we made the movie. The interesting thing about it was that I didn't come up with the title of Jagged Edge. It just after the script was finished and as we were going into production, we desperately needed a new title because the one I had, Hearts of Fire, wasn't very good, and it really didn't fit the movie in any way. So. We all tried to come up with a title. I couldn't come up with it either. And Guy gave it to his assistant. She read the script, and in the description of the knife, in my script, it said, the description called it a knife with a jagged edge. Those two words leaped out at her, and that's where we got our title.
Interesting. I love it. Creative process is a wonderful one.
Is it? It really is. I love the kind of magical, serendipitous process of creativity and the creative process. I mean, yeah. How do you get that title? Well, that's how. When
Oh, well, all of you out there, stay with us. We're going to take a real short break, and when we return, we will be back with more Joe Esterhaz, so please don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals, Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. Broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also streaming live on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Also, we podcast, and if you go to my website at penonfire.com, click on the radio tower, you will arrive at the radio page. There you can follow directions and listen to many of the past shows that have been on the show, on for how long now? 9 years? I've been on for something like that. And this show with Joe Esterhaus will be podcast hopefully next week or the week after. So you can catch it again and tell everyone you know who missed it to listen. I'm going to bring Joe Esterhaus back on. Hi there.
Hi, Barbara.
And his most recent book is The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, The Screenwriter as God, published by St. Martin's Press. And it truly is one of the best books, if not the best book on screenwriting. You give so many tips, and the way the book is arranged, too, it's the sort of book that you can sort of dip into. You don't have to read from start to finish, which definitely appeals to my style of reading. How did you come up with this structure?
Well, let me tell you, I came up with the title first. I've always loved the writing of Ambrose Bierce, who I thought in some ways was more talented than Twain. He was a contemporary of Twain's, who worked for the San Francisco Chronicle. Wrote these mordant, odd sketches, and then wrote a little book called The Devil's Dictionary, which sort of took a very skewed, very funny, but very dark view of the world. So, if we're talking about movies, movie people use the word homage a lot when they steal. Hopefully I didn't steal Bierce's title. Hopefully it really is an homage. But that's why I called it The Devil's Guide to Hollywood. And in terms of the structure, I wanted to write a kind of anti-textbook textbook. Because most textbooks I've always found to be profoundly boring. And frankly, I was never a very good student. So the notion of me writing a textbook, some people would think would be drop-dead outrageous. Some people who know me or went to school with me. But I thought that if I wrote a textbook, it would be truly funny. So it's done in the manner of a textbook, but it's really an anti-textbook textbook.
I love some of these tips you have too. You say don't watch TV if you're writing. Hunter S. Thompson said no music and bad TV equals bad mood and no pages.
Isn't that true?
It's true.
Isn't that true? I think it's great. Now, you know, I knew Hunter and I worked with Hunter at Rolling Stone. And one of the reasons that I wound up at Rolling Stone magazine was because of Hunter. And I have to say that I also got an awful lot of really bad, twisted advice from Hunter, but that's very good. I think this is really good.
Now, talk about dealing with writer's block, because you talk about it a bit in the book.
Well, what I've always found, knock on wood, and praise God so far, is that when I get stuck on something, and there's a good shot. If I can't go anywhere with it, there's a good shot that if I go back to the very beginning and begin by redoing all of it, literally, physically rewriting all of it from the first page on, that and put myself into it from the first page on, that I will find the spot where it sort of went astray, and that it would free me up from that kind of block. In terms of a more serious block, and a lasting block. The worst I've ever had in my life was after, you know, after my throat surgery for cancer. I had to stop smoking and drinking at the same time, and I discovered that it was, well, first I discovered that it was the single most difficult thing that I ever had to do, something that I wasn't sure I could do. And secondly, I discovered that my writing was totally tied into smoking all the time. As I wrote, and sometimes sipping some white wine or a beer while I wrote. And I got horrendously blocked for like a year and a half. It was very difficult for me to write because I stopped both things. And then after I substituted walking 5 miles a day for it, which I still do obsessively 5 years down the line. And after about a year and a half, I started straightening out and I was able to sit down again and start writing without those two things at my side. That's the most serious block that I've ever been in. And frankly, I had to work my way through psychologically, both with the physical exercise, you know, the obsessive physical exercise just to keep myself straight from smoking and drinking, you know, and then be able to write at the same time.
How did your writing change, or did it?
Well, I don't know. Naomi says that it's a kindler and gentler Joe, but I think if you read The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, The Screenwriter's Guide, she's wrong.
I do,
you?
Too.
I don't know.
Interesting.
Maybe it's changed in one sense. I wrote a movie that's coming out on the 23rd of October. It's premiering in Budapest and in Hungary, and then coming to this country in early next year at the film festivals, and it will be distributed in this country. Anyway, it's called The Children of Glory, and it's about the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 and Hungary taking on the Russians and beating them out of the country, with the Hungarians doing it with sticks and stones in their hands. And at the very core of it is a very touching and moving love story. I just saw the movie for the first time about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and it really worked. And it works because I think the love story is very effective. So maybe Naomi is right, and maybe there is a kindler and gentler Joe at work. And there's no sex in it at all, so how about that?
Well, you speak about smoking and giving up smoking and drinking, and in your book you say, don't show your character smoking in your script.
Yes, that's right. After my cancer surgery, I started an organization, a grassroots little organization here in Cleveland called Join Joe at the Cleveland Clinic. And a good part of it that I did was to write about and write the studios and write articles saying, please don't show smoking in the movies because of the profound effect that it has on kids. In the course of setting up Join Joe, I got hundreds, literally hundreds of email responses from people who were able to identify what movie it was specifically that began them smoking. I mean, I think all the evidence is really clear that it is the greatest single influence for people to smoke. There's also a memo from one of the tobacco company executives who says, we can have no greater advertising than a cigarette in the hands of a movie star. Hmm. And awfully, tragically, you know, many of our young movie stars who have causes that they very fervently believe in, you know, humanitarian causes that they testify to Congress about, are the same people who will be smoking up on screen. I've written about that, and I went on a kind of a mini campaign about that with the studios, you know, and both behind the scenes and up front to try to change that.
Mm, interesting.
Incidentally, I began with myself because I was certainly guilty of this. And the, you know, in Basic Instinct, smoking is a character, of course. But in many of my movies, people smoke, and I think that I partly did it because I was a militant smoker, and I was making a huge point in my mind about political correctness. And only when I had my throat surgery, in a sense, when I maimed myself with what I had done, did I realize what I had done to myself and what potentially I was doing to others. So it's become a real campaign in my life, and I've done what I can among screenwriters, behind the scenes in Hollywood, and also in articles in the New York Times and the Daily Variety, you know, to try to make up in some sense for the things that I myself did.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Joe Esterhaus today. And his new book is The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, The Screenwriter is God, from St. Martin's. I wanted to ask you about, before I forget, about Music Box.
Yes.
And where that story came from.
Well, the story came from when I was growing up as a boy in an emigre society in Cleveland. I noticed anti-Semitism everywhere around me among the emigres. As I grew older, I realized that what had happened at the end of the Second World War is that a lot of the people who actually left Hungary and countries like Hungary and came to the United States came under the umbrella of anti-communism, and they espoused and preached anti-communism in an effort to hide their own complicity in terms of aiding the Nazis, you know, or actually being a part of Nazi governments. So I wrote this piece, having seen it around me all my life. And I wrote the piece in about 1987 or so. In 1990, the Justice Department began an investigation of my father for allegedly having committed war criminal activities having to do with his writings, with anti-Semitic writings, while he was a member of the propaganda ministry in Hungary. I didn't consciously, certainly, know about my father's involvement in any of those things. And in Hollywood Animal, I deal it great depth with my relationship with my dad, how it changed, and what happened. Because my father, as I grew up, really taught me to view only character as a determinant with people, never skin color, never religion. When these charges happened, I wondered whether he did that, in regret of what he himself had done, or in some ways whether, like the character in Music Box, he was setting up an alibi for himself in case it ever hit the fan. It is one of the great tragedies of my life, and as I say in that book, I try to deal with it. My father died in 2001, and we never really reconciled after those hearings happened.
I remember that movie well, and it was such a powerful story.
It is one of the movies that I'm proudest of. I've taken a lot of criticism from Hungarians through the years, who feel that I betrayed Hungary and Hungarians by putting up on screen what happened at the end of the war. And one of the reasons I'm very happy having written Children of Glory now is that it shows Hungarians in a heroic spirit, in terms of great glory that they achieved. And hopefully Hungarians won't be mad at me as much anymore. So you see, there really is a kindler and gentler Joe at work.
Are we going to be able to see that one?
My wife, as always, is right.
Will we be able to see that one? You said it's opening in Budapest, but
on the 23rd of October in Budapest, which is the 50th anniversary of the revolution that I'm writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's coming here early next spring, early in the year. It stars Kata Dobo, D-O-B-O, Hungary's Hungary's biggest star, and it was produced by Andrew Vajna, who produced one of the producers of Music Box, and also produced the Terminator movies here.
Mm, okay, look forward to that one.
Thank you.
Do you think there's ageism in Hollywood as regards screenwriters?
I'm sure. It is very much a young person's game. Many of the studio executives today are in their late 20s or early 30s. You know, there's that very famous story, you know, about Fred Zinnemann, who was then in his 70s, you know, going into early 70s, going into a studio meeting with a young studio executive, you know, and he sits down and the studio executive says, okay, now, Mr. Zinnemann, can you tell me what exactly you've done? And Zinnemann looks at him and says, let's begin with you. Why don't you tell me what you've done? which I really loved. But I think it's natural in a situation where the executives are 20, you know, mid-20s to early 30s, and where they desperately try to skew toward a really young audience, and today it's a really young audience they're skewing to. Yes, you know, it makes sense that there's a kind of ageism. It's awful, but it makes sense.
So how do you get beyond it as say, an older screenwriter trying to break in?
I think the only way, and I, you know, and I get back to the biggest point of the book, the only way to get beyond it is write the script itself. Write it as a spec. Don't go in and try to sell it and to try to hustle people in their mid-20s, early 30s. Write it. If it's good, if they think that people will see it, then it's, believe me, it won't matter how old you are.
Do you think it's important to write it with someone in mind, with someone that you would like to maybe attach to it?
Barbara. There's some people who believe in that, but I really have never done that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in terms of my own casting, you know, I'm way off. For example, in Basic Instinct, Michael, as I wrote it, I thought Michael Douglas was a possibility for it. But to show you how off I usually am, if you remember, Michael's sidekick in that movie was beautifully played by George Zunza, that big steelworker-looking ethnic actor who was also in The Deer Hunter.
Yes.
My thought for that part was Willie Nelson. You know, so as I wrote it, it was Willie Nelson. So, no, I've never been very good that way.
Oh, we have a few minutes left with Joe Esterhaus. His book is The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, and so much more to talk about. You work on a manual typewriter.
I do.
Talk about that.
I'm a total troglodyte, Luddite.
I think, you know, some of the most prolific writers are using typewriters, I swear.
Naomi keeps saying that, you know, I call a cell phone a gizmo, and, you know, and she's right. I do. I grew up with a manual typewriter, and I always hit the keys so hard that I couldn't, with two fingers, and I couldn't even use electric machines, let alone the computer. I bought about 14 or 15 Olivetti Lettera manual typewriters through the course of the past 10 or so years. They're all stacked up in my closet. I think there are about 10 left. I'm 62 years old. I think the 10 will last. even if I beat them to death after three or four scripts, I think they'll last long enough so that they'll be around as long as I'll be around.
So
you know what's a real problem, though, that I didn't think about is the typewriters are there, but typewriter ribbons are a real issue. And we had to go on a huge hunt a couple of years ago to get enough ribbons. I was paranoid. I was frightened to death. And finally, we located a whole stack of ribbons, ironically finding the manual typewriter ribbons on the Internet.
That's so interesting. Some would say, well, how could you possibly, you know, write on a typewriter when you have to retype the whole thing over and over again?
Well, I actually begin with longhand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I write it the very first draft, and, you know, I write with a pencil or a pen, then type. And I find that in the retyping over and over again, I'm really editing and polishing. You know, so I don't mind that process. It's a laborious, lengthy process, but I think I'm carving it each time and making it tighter.
And I would say it's working for you.
Thank you.
Over and over again. You also say in your book, don't talk too much about your projects.
Yeah, I think that if you talk it out, it somehow takes the creative juice out of actually sitting down and writing it. You know, I've known writers who tell their stories and sort of act the stories out and do the telling very, very well. But it somehow loses the magic, and they never wind up sitting down and writing it. The other reason, of course, is that I think if you tell it, at an infant stage, I think a story in your head is very, very vulnerable, so that if you tell it and someone makes a suggestion, it can jolt you off into a different area, or it can hurt coming up with your own thoughts to pin it to perhaps to complete it.
Yeah, so true. You say you should know where your story is going, but don't know too much.
Yeah, I didn't for when I wrote Basic Instinct, I didn't outline it. I in a sense, I'd done an awful lot of research for it because, as a journalist, I'd been around policemen who were burned out. I had spent a lot of time with sociopaths and with mass murderers, even interviewing some of them, like Ed Kemper, the one in Santa Cruz. The turf had always fascinated me, and I knew a lot about it. But when I actually started writing it, I didn't outline it, and it came in a kind of blind flash. You know, I didn't know where it was going to end. It was the only script where I really use music. For whatever reason, I've always loved the Rolling Stones, and for whatever reason with this piece, I kept playing Sympathy for the Devil over and over again. And from the time that I began writing it to the time that my agent sold it, it was 13 days. It was the only time that anything like that had ever happened to me. I was literally getting up at night taking notes. It was as though the characters were dictating their lines to me. The whole thing happening in a kind of a wild, blind, creative flash. Incidentally, the irony with Sympathy for the Devil was that when the movie was completed, Carol Cohen and Paul Verhoeven decided to put Sympathy for the Devil over the back credits, and they paid the Stones $750,000 to do that. Then they changed their minds and decided not to. So the Stones kept the money. But Sympathy for the Devil never made it into the movie.
Now, where did that one come from? Where did that movie come from?
You mean Basic?
Yeah.
I think some parts came from. I had done Jagged Edge and Music Box, and they were movies where men manipulated women. In Jagged Edge's case, a lover, and in Music Box's case, a father. And I wanted to do a piece where a woman who was absolutely brilliant and beautiful and sexual, ballsy and smart, manipulates men to her own twisted goals. Catherine Tremell does that and does it beautifully on all kinds of levels, on sexual levels and interrogation levels. She's a sociopath, but she's an absolutely brilliant homicidal sociopath. I think after the movie came out, there was a terrific amount of controversy about it. But years down the line, both Camille Paglia and Naomi Wolf came out and really praised the movie and praised the character, especially in terms of being a post-feminist hero. And I think that is really what I was trying to achieve.
Yeah, you do write interesting women.
Thank you. I think the greatest compliment that you mentioned Music Box before that I've gotten from a critic, and I have not gotten many. but Michael Schragau in The New Yorker said that Jessica Lange, the character of Ann Talbot, played by Jessica Lange in Music Box, was the ultimate feminist hero. And I was very happy to read that.
Yeah, what a great character she was. Oh, now I'm going to have to rent all these movies again and watch them and with a whole different perspective.
Did you ever see a little movie that I did called Big Shots?
No.
It's a kid's story about two little boys going off on an adventure. I wrote it when my oldest son Steve was 11. He and I were very, very close, and I started worrying about what would happen to him if something happened to me. That's the beginning point of the movie. And then his dad dies, and this little boy goes on an adventure, meets a black kid who's searching for his father, and they go off together. It's one of my favorite little movies, and HBO played it endlessly for a long time during the day. But I wish you'd see it. It's a fun movie.
Oh, I'm going to look for that.
Great.
I'm going to definitely look for that.
Great.
We're at the end of our time. You're going to be down this way September 20th. You're going to be at the Writers Guild Foundation.
Yes.
And then Thursday the 21st, Book Soup in L.A.
Yes.
And Saturday the 23rd, Barnes & Noble on the 3rd Street Promenade.
Yes, after which I will need a new right arm. Yes, thank you.
Oh, that's great. It's just great. Can you do you have any words of wisdom for the struggling writers listening?
Yes, there's a German word that's Sitzfleisch. It's Sitzfleisch, and I have to say that there aren't many German words that I've liked through the years. This one means the ability to sit on your butt. Sit on your butt and write. That's what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to party. You're not supposed to run around. You're not supposed to have too much fun if you're a writer. You know, writing is bad for your eyes. You're supposed to sit in a room, and you get lower back problems. But if you are a writer, sit on your butt and write.
Yeah, yeah, the best advice.
The other advice I'd have together with that is read, especially in terms of screenwriters. Don't see all those horrible movies out there, because you're going to write characters, even the good movies, you're going to write characters that are based on other movies. Read. Let the process of envisioning it in your own head from words happen. It will help your writing.
Mm. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you,
on,
Barbara.
Joe.
This was really a pleasure. I don't say that often with interviews, but this was really fun. I thank you.
Be great to have you back when the movie comes to the U.S.
Thank you.
In the spring.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Joe Esterhaus speaking to us from his home in Ohio. What a pleasure. And what a great guy. And as I said, he has been my screenwriting hero for many years. So it was just great to talk with him. We'll podcast the show in a week or two. So check with penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower and it'll bring you to the radio page. There you will also not only find out about the podcast, but also who's going to be coming on the show. What else? I think that's it. And I'm going to leave you with a quote, actually a quote from The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, Joe's book. And he says, "Take it from Zsa Zsa. If you get depressed," said my Hungarian compatriot Zsa Zsa Gabor, "take a bath and wash your hair." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book's Pen on Fire, and I'm going to see you next time. Be well.